In China, about 1500 years ago, when the text was brought there, it gave birth to a school of Buddhism that was quite distinct. It's called Huayan Buddhism. And really, my book is about Huayan Buddhism, and it refers to the sutra, but it's about the whole tradition that emerged from the sutra. And the Flower Garland Sutra is super long. It's the longest sutra that there is. It's about 1400 pages in English translation, small print, large volume. A student who's from China, who's a monastic from China, recently told me it's 1 million Chinese characters. So that's a lot if you're not good at math. And I will say that means it's about 1 million words. This book is about 40,000 words. So it's about 25 times as many words as this. So anyway, when I really wanted to help people understand the themes of the work and the value of it, but it just seemed pretty overwhelming until an amazing person named Dr. Jin Park, a professor of religion, pointed me towards a text called the Ocean Seal Chart. It also has many other names. It's a Korean text that's 30 lines, 7 Chinese characters each. That's very prevalent and influential in Korean Buddhisms, and is intended to be, it was written about 1500 years ago, and is intended to be a compact summation of the themes, the teachings of Huayan Buddhism and of the sutra. So this is just a simple thing for anyone who wants to write a book. If you want to comment on a text with 1 million characters or 210 is going to be easier. So this book is a new translation and commentary on the Ocean Seal Chart from Korea. So there's 30 lines in the text, so there's 30 chapters, one chapter of commentary for each line. So it's general background. The themes of the tradition that I will be focusing on, and I think are central to Huayan and the sutra itself, are celebration of abundance and celebration of the sensual world. Those of you who are familiar with early Buddhism may know that early Buddhism is not characterized by celebration of abundance and celebration of the sensual world. So Huayan distinctly takes Buddhism to new places. Very positive, joyful, expansive, abundant places. So, celebration of abundance, celebration of the sensual world, celebration of interdependence. Most people would say this is the principal hallmark of Huayan, the emphasis on interdependence and the wonder and beauty of it. And then, celebration of social engagement and the diversity of people, of their needs, and of their practices. So these are the themes that I will be talking about this evening that are pervasive in the tradition. So first theme I want to talk about is abundance. In the Ocean Seal Chart, we encounter these lines. The abundant manifestations of wish fulfillment are inconceivable. This rain of jewels benefits all life, filling all space. All beings benefit according to their capacities. So, rain. Picture rain. This place is called Dharma Rain. Surprise! We might have some kind of connection. So, the Flower Garland Sutra is extremely visual and extremely sensual. So, many people will say that in the Huayan tradition, the Dharma is seen, it is smelled, and it is touched more than it is heard. It's not a verbal expression, but a sensory experience. So, anyway, a rain of jewels that benefits all life, filling all space. That sounds pretty abundant. So, just picture like it's raining. This happens, right? And everywhere, rain, every raindrop is a jewel. A rain of jewels, diamonds, rubies, emeralds, sapphires, citrines. I don't know. Does anyone know any other jewels? A vision of absolutely staggering beauty and preciousness filling every element of your field of vision. So you might think, I'm not sure about that. But this emphasis on abundance, beauty, preciousness is medicine in two principal ways. One, by viewing the world as very abundant, one can be free of the interest in grasping anything, because why would you bother? There's plenty. You don't need to hold on. There's plenty. And so the focus of your actions can be on meeting the actual material needs of the people around you rather than trying to get things. So this is the first way in which the theme of abundance that we see pervasively in this tradition is medicine. The second is that the Korean commentators on the Ocean Seal chart, all the ones I found, they all say, what does the jewels represent? And it says jewels represent skillful means. So skillful means is a term that many of you may find quite familiar, but what does it mean? Skillful means refers to the capacity right now for any sentient being to do something that is effective and conducive to the liberation of suffering for everyone forever. That's what skillful means is about. So the Four Noble Truths basically says, if there's consciousness, there's the ability to do something conducive to liberation for everyone. It doesn't say there's Four Noble Truths, and on Tuesday you can be mindful, and on Thursday you can practice right speech. No, it says it's always available. So these teachers are saying, when we think about this unbelievably precious, mind-boggling array of jewels, the point is to see the unbelievably precious, mind-boggling array of skillful means or capacities to engage in liberation. So let's just be like really narrow in our understanding of sentient beings. So we're just only going to include humans, which is not very nice, but I'll just do that for this thought experiment. There are 8 billion people in the world right now. An utterly mind-boggling number. There's science showing we can't understand really what that means, what a billion means. Every single one of those people right now has the capacity to do something which is conducive to liberation from suffering for everyone forever. And that's been true since you were born, and it will be true long after you die, and it will be true for every moment of your life. So you and everyone you see and all these people that are beyond comprehension all have the capacity to engage in liberation always. This dwarfs the paltry image of a rain of jewels in how mind-boggling it is to live in a world where this is possible. So I had a pretty vivid sense of this already. I've been studying Huayan and just watching practice happen. And so it felt pretty true to me, but nothing made it seem more true than living in Minneapolis for the last several months. And I will talk a little bit more about things I've seen in Minneapolis the last several months later, but I'm just going to focus on one very small thing, which I happen to be a part of, one of many, many things I happen to be a part of, which was not the many other things that lots of other people were doing. So in early December, a friend of mine said, we know that when ICE came to Portland, when they came to LA, when they came to Chicago, they used brutal tactics and it was really dangerous. And they're talking about bringing way more people to Minneapolis. The ratio of officers to people they brought to Minneapolis was 20 times higher than to any other city they've ever come to. So we knew they were coming. So my friend said, you know, we have lots of mutual aid groups, but I want to start a new one with a particular focus on delivering groceries to immigrant families who can't leave home because it's not safe. So we're just going to make one form where you can say, I want to sign up to have groceries delivered, and another one where you say, I'd like to deliver groceries. So that was early December. Mid-December, we were at a meeting, and they were like, yeah, we've already got like 40 or 50 people, and I need like a volunteer to just manage the volunteers now because we need someone to look at the database and line people up and all that sort of thing. Well, a couple months later, there were thousands of people. This is just one of many, many projects like this, thousands of people. And it wasn't just delivering food. It was driving people to work. It was accompanying people to court. It was picking people up at the federal courthouse or the federal building. And also we'd realized there are a lot of people who haven't been leaving home, so they can't pay their rent. So we started raising money. And by mid-March, we'd raised $5.7 million just in this neighborhood organization that's not even a nonprofit that was formed like 3 months before. So what happens when people just say, we have what we need to take care of each other? amazing things can happen. And that was just a tiny one of many things that I personally was a part of. And I don't even know half the things that were happening. By the way, thanks for the green frogs. It's inspiration. It's a possibility. What do you do when people are really violent? Put on a frog costume? Of course. Ride through the city naked on bicycles? Hell yeah. All right. So I would like to do take a little moment for some meditation practice. And this will be a practice that is focused on recognizing abundance. So you are welcome to sit in any way that you like. How about that? For some rigid instructions. But I am going to invite you to do some visualizing. So I'm going to encourage you to close your eyes. And let's just start by just noticing the sensations in the body right now. And just checking in with any emotion or affect that is present. Now I'm going to invite you to recall things that happened in the last couple of days that supported you. And so this could be, you know, whatever that means to you. So this could be like a person or a conversation. You know, someone gave you a hug or smiled at you. It could be like a bed because you were literally physically supported by it if you were lying down, or like a spoonful of oatmeal. Food sustains our life, or a breath. So just thinking about things that happened in the last couple of days that supported you. And if there's something that's like meaningful that you want to like focus on remembering and re-experiencing, that's great. Or if you just want to list many and various things, just kind of let your imagination and your recollection intersect in recalling things in the last couple of days that, let's let that particular imagination and recollection go and just rest in what's here right now. And I'm going to invite you to notice things that are here right now that are supportive to you in any way that is meaningful to you. And if this seems difficult, each moment of every breath, profoundly valuable to your survival. Now, I invite you to put down this particular activity and just thinking about support. Just notice right now that there are sensations of the body, sound, perhaps there are emotions present, feeling. Notice visual images, whether the eyes are open or closed.
Excuse me, I think we've lost sound on the Zoom. Have others lost sound on Zoom? Okay.
Thank you. Are y'all hearing me there again? C'est bon. Okay. So I will recite these lines from the Ocean Seal chart. Within one is all. Within many is one. One is all. The many are one. Within one mote of dust is contained the 10 directions. And within each phenomena, it is also thus. Immeasurable distant eons are one moment of mind, and one moment of mind is immeasurable eons. Okay. Still good? All right. The basic idea is that since each thing depends on everything, you can't really pull any part out of the interdependent system that makes everything. And so any particular thing contains the whole web of the entirety of what has ever been and what ever will be and everything that is everywhere. And not only that, the entire universe can only exist in each particular distinct form. So your consciousness is utterly necessary, like right now, for the entire universe to exist, as do all the things that you think you are perceiving as separate phenomena, which ultimately are not. So I think I'm just going to read a little bit from the book. Oh, yes. Supposed to read something else. I got so excited about meditating, I forgot about reading. I'm going to go backwards and read something about abundance, okay? Can we recall? What was that? This is about abundance. This teaching is to evoke a sense of abundance. It is to cut through anxiety, alienation, and clinging. Early Buddhist texts focus on giving things up so we can be free of our clinging. Huayan emphasizes seeing a world so replete with riches that we feel no need to hold on. Huayan teachers understand that the abundant manifestations require our actual giving. In his commentary on this line, Pob Young writes, "It may be compared to the wish-fulfilling gem possessed by a wheel-turning king. If it is kept in the royal treasury, it does not rain down all manner of treasures." End quote. In a Pali canon text, so this is from the earliest layer of Buddhist teachings, a king gets wise counsel on how to deal with bandits overrunning the realm. His advisor tells him that punishment and violence will not end the epidemic of crime. But, and here I quote the Pali canon, quote, "With this plan, you can completely eliminate the plague of crime. To those in the kingdom who are engaged in cultivating crops and raising cattle, let your majesty distribute grain and fodder. To those in trade, give capital. To those in government service, assign proper living wages. Then those people, being intent on their own occupations, will not harm the kingdom. Your majesty's revenues will be great, the land will be tranquil and not be beset by thieves, and the people, with joy in their hearts, playing with their children, will dwell in open houses." So you may have encountered the idea that if you want to end crime, punishment and violence are not as effective as providing people the resources they need to thrive. There are many contemporary movements based on this. Prison abolitionism and police abolitionism are two examples, but there are many other ones. And in case you think this is a very novel new idea, well, it is in the Pali Canon, which is pretty darn old. So, I do want to come back here, though, to this reading I wanted to do about interdependence. And we have here this. Yeah, well, I think I'll just read this. So Weesong is the Korean monk who is the author of the Ocean Seal chart text on which this book is a commentary. When Weesong traveled to China for the Dharma, he met a woman named Sunmyo who fell in love with him. He told her that his vow of celibacy meant he could not requite her love, and her ardor to protect him on his path transformed her into a dragon. After years of caring for him on his travels, she became a great stone hovering over invaders outside one of the first temples he founded. She is perched there right now, a great stone guardian overlooking the temple of the floating stone, Buseoksa, near Jeonju City in Korea. The times of myth, of history, and of the present moment can collapse in a good story. Trauma, too, can make the interpenetration of times vivid. Yesterday, someone described being overwhelmed by emotions during an argument with a friend. Suddenly, they had the jarring experience of being a three-year-old child, feeling the same rage, the same need to hold someone at bay that was showing up in their present life. This collapsing of time and identity rang true to my own experience when I was receiving treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder. Somehow, I could be totally aware of my own bodily sensations, my own present moment sensory environment, my own agency in adulthood, and also absolutely be the terrified child consumed by shame, terror, and rage who in linear time had grown up 30 years ago. Teachings on karma have much in common with contemporary theories of trauma. So does the Hawaiian emphasis on the interpenetration of past, present, and future. Scientific data show the deep relationship between a child struggling to find food and safety in an impoverished neighborhood and an adult being pushed into a prison cell. Understanding karma can help us know the importance of our actions. Knowing interdependence opens up the space for compassion and shows that we can create conditions for freedom for everyone. And Hawaiian Buddhism has all these different theoretical frameworks, literary expressions, all kinds of ways to help us recognize interdependence and its implications. But my favorite one is probably pretty popular in this place, which is to stop adding any layers. So, you know, there are many ways to practice meditation, but oftentimes Zazen is simply the activity of not dividing the world up. So when we just rest in what is here, the activity of mind that's constantly dividing it is quieted or stilled, and what is revealed is the seamlessness of this moment and of the world. So if all this seems too heady, that's great. You can be really cool Zen people and just come here and sit and pull the weeds. So I would like to now chant with you. I'm going to pass out a sheet of paper. And for our beloved Zoom host, who's figured it out already, is going to share something on screen. I'm going to pass this out. I'm going to encourage you to not just start reading it, but just you just have it, and then we'll chant it together, and then that's it. And I have to retrieve these because these are the only copies I have, and I have five more events on this tour. So, I'll send those around. So these are copies of the text I've been calling the Ocean Seal Chart. This text also has multiple names. And so on this one, it's called the Seal of the Hawaiian One Vehicle Dharma Realm. Catchy, I know. So in a moment, we can chant it. I think you'll understand how the chanting is happening fairly quickly. I'll chant the title and you can join in with me. And I'll wait just a moment so everyone, do we have enough? Happy day. All right. Here we go. Seal of the Hawaiian One Vehicle Dharma Realm. Dharma, nature is all-pervading harmony without duality. All dharmas are unmoving, fundamentally peaceful, without name, without characteristic, cutting through all. It is known in real life, wisdom not in another realm. True nature is so very profound, minutely subtle, not attached to self. Nature, it arises dependent on condition. Within one is all, within many is one, one is all. We are one, within one mode of dust is contained the 10 directions. Within each phenomena, it is also the measurable distance beyond our one moment of mind. One moment of mind is a measurable beyond. Are mutually identical, yet not mixed or disorder, they arise separately. Just aspiration for awakening is true awakening. Life, death, and nirvana always identical. The universe and particulars are thus unfathomable, not distinct. This the realm of the ten Buddhas, Samantabhadra, the great ones in the midst of the Buddha's ocean sea, Samadhi, the abundant manifestation of wish fulfillment, are inconceivable. This rain of jewel benefits all beings, filling all space, all beings benefit according to their capacity. Thus the practitioner returns to the true source without any delusion. It is surely not attained. Unconditional skillful means bring wish fulfillment, return home effortlessly, gaining treasures through Dharani, and inexhaustible treasure adorns the Dharma realm. To jewel palace, just sitting in the bed of the middle way, the ultimate reality, this original stillness is named Buddha. I'm going to invite you to just put the text down and let your eyes close. And see if any part of what you just heard or chanted comes back to you, like a word or a phrase or an image from the text. And you don't have to remember exactly what it is. So it could just sort of be like, there's something about time or, you know, dust. So just see if any image or word or phrase shows up as being of resonance or interest. And if something emerged or you recalled something, you can look at the text and see if you can locate the line in which that image or phrase occurs. And now I'm going to invite people, probably not everyone because of the size of the group, to just say the line that you heard. And we're going to use the mic so everyone can hear. We'll start with people in the room and then go online. So
raise your hand if you'd like to share, and I'll pass you the mic.
It may be easy if we sort of move in a direction. So start here and just move the mic down this way.
All beings benefit according to their capacities.
The mind's first aspiration for awakening is true awakening.
The times are not mutually identical, yet not mixed or disordered.
Immeasurable distant eons are one moment of mind.
This rain of jewels benefits all life, filling all space.
All beings benefit according to their capacities.
The abundant manifestations of wish fulfillment are inconceivable.
Within one mote of dust is contained the ten directions.
Dharma nature is all pervading harmony without duality.
True nature is so very profound, minutely subtle.
This original stillness is named Buddha.
And I think we'll go online and you want to say one there, Eldon?
Within one is all, within many is one.
Thank you. Wonderful. And let's go online. Anyone want to share?
I can start, and then anyone who wants to unmute, maybe raise your hand and I'll unmute you. All dharmas are unmoving, fundamentally peaceful.
I
Last call for online. Okay.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. Thank you. So at the end, you can just stack those up over there on the floor. You don't have to do it right now. It's we're leaving. So I'm going to talk about two more themes, and then we're going to see what happens with all these voices. So next theme, particularity and activity. So because the universe only exists as it expressed in each particular thing, and each particular thing is the whole universe, everything becomes unutterably precious. And this really is where you see why Yen has had such a big impact on Soto Zen. Because I don't know how you're practicing, what your style is, but you know, people are like, why do we all walk, you know, everyone turns at exactly the right moment and bows in exactly this way, and you all wash, clean off your cushion before you stand up and you fluff it up. And it's because all those things matter. So early Buddhism really focuses on a psychological process of investigating the content of consciousness from the what we might say is the personal side. And Huayan turns the lens outward and makes the practice about what we would think of as the material world, although ultimately it's seamlessly part of consciousness, but that's another question. But it will seem to us like this bell. And so you hear Thich Nhat Hanh extolling the virtues of the bell. Why? By showing that it contains everything. All that Thich Nhat Hanh teaching about how the bell contains the hands who made it, and the sun and the stars, all that is direct Huayan teaching. He uses Huayan as one of the main bases for his whole framework. So I'm just going to read a little bit here on this subject. So this is a commentary on the seventh line of the text, so it's seventh chapter. Within one is all, within many is one. If you want to sum up Huayan teachings in a single line, this is as good as it gets. The idea that each thing contains everything and everything is holding each thing pervades the tradition. The implications are vast. When I interviewed people for an article about Tomoe Katagiri, who was central in transmitting the practice of hand sewing Zen religious garments to North America, her student Andrea Martin said, "Tomoe-san continually showed that everything matters." End quote. If the whole world is here in this cup of tea, this stitch, or this bow, don't you want to care for it? The Huayan master Jian wrote, because in the Huayan, phenomena are the teaching, whatever phenomena are brought up, inexhaustible teachings are included. End quote. Because everything is precious, discernment about how to care for things is precious. Once Tomoe was carefully making us a cup of tea. Apropos of something we've been talking about a moment before, I began to quote a line from the Metta Sutra. She put down the tea things and faced me with her whole being, relaxed, poised, and alert. When the quote from the sutra was over, she returned to the tea. In Huizong's commentary on this poem, he repeatedly refers to the teaching of the 10 coins. This is a common Huayan metaphor. If you have 10 coins, any one of them completely contains all 10. For if you remove that one, there is no 10. Within the 10 coins, each one is completely contained in the 10, for if the 10 were gone, so too would be the one. More subtly, if part of the 10 were gone, the one would no longer be the exact same one it was. It wouldn't be the one that is thus in this particular relational context. If a bowl of soup costs 10 coins, the one as part of 10 coins is sufficient. As part of 9, it is not. It is practical for people to agree that one coin always has the same value as one coin, but this is a limited view. A $50 parking ticket means something very different to someone who is hungry and poor than it does to someone with thousands, millions, or billions of dollars in the bank. The power of one coin to buy a cup of tea or 10 coins to buy a bowl of soup contains the entire universe, which shows up in the form of a mutual agreement between people about the value of a piece of metal. Let us practice looking at money not just in terms of what we have and what we can get, but how this money impacts the whole and hence particular individuals within that whole. Our shared agreements about money often hide the fact that within the whole of our economy, many individual people work all day for just enough money to live beneath a freeway overpass. These shared agreements can make it seem that someone who doesn't have a job deserves to live under a freeway overpass. Seeing that one is all, we can do better. So Hannah Arendt is a philosopher. She was a Jewish woman who escaped Europe in the late 30s prior to the onset of the Holocaust and emigrated to the United States, where she was a very influential writer. She wrote about a lot of things, but she wrote quite a bit about how authoritarianism comes to be and how to prevent it from coming to be, a subject which I have been finding of great interest lately for some reason. So she once wrote, "Even the smallest act in the most limited circumstances bears the seed of boundlessness. Even the smallest act in the most limited circumstances bears the seed of boundlessness." For those of you who have been studying the Flower Garland Sutra, doesn't that feel like it could just be in the text? And it certainly could be in any Huayan text. But it wasn't. It was Hannah Arendt. So she's talking about various things, but one of the reasons she points this out is that there is a tendency with authoritarianism to focus on the authoritarian leader and their principal cronies and be like, those people are evil and horrible, and we need to get rid of them, and then all good. And her argument and one of her main themes is that authoritarianism exists with the millions and millions of acts of active support for it and passive complicity with what it is doing. And that's how you have authoritarianism. She's, you know, coined the phrase the banality of evil, writing about Eichmann and his, he's just like, I'm just a bureaucrat. I'm just putting people on trains. So this is interesting to me because for the last 6 months, I've been part of a crew providing trainings in how to not cooperate with authoritarianism in Minneapolis. And the training that we have is designed by a group called Freedom Trainers, and it's based in social science research on the last 100 years, places where there's been an authoritarian breakthrough, like the United States, most recently, but in other places. And where did you end up with an authoritarian state, and where was that authoritarian breakthrough prevented, and they sustained a democracy? So these social scientists determined these are the things that seem to have been effective. And so the training that we have is just based on these are the effective things that you can do. And one of the main themes of the training is that everybody is part of systems that are upholding the authoritarian state. And everyone has their different positionalities in their capacity to prevent it from functioning. So people, you know, we use, like, there's this rubric of pillars. So there's an educational pillar, a religious pillar, my specialty. There's the business pillar. There's the governmental pillar. So everyone has connections within all of these, and they have influence. And so it's just like this invitation to sort of look, well, where is your positionality in all of this? And what's your capacity? So in Buddhism, we have the idea that we're in a massive systemic pattern of suffering, and it is possible to go against the stream, to quote the Pali Canon, to go against the stream of suffering and towards liberation. And that, as it says in the sutras that use that term, is what practice is. So one other thing about particularity and activity also comes from my hometown. So after George Floyd was murdered, there was a lot of rage. And, you know, the area outside the third precinct where the officers who killed him were based, there was this massive encampment of people. And within a few days, the precinct was burned down. But at the site of the murder itself, 38th in Chicago, within hours, it became a site of vigil, of spirituality, of community building, and it still is. So he started like a daily community building meeting at George Floyd Square right away, and it's still happening. This is a long time ago, 6 years. You drive by, it's 5 degrees below zero, You drive down 38th Street and look over at 9 o'clock in the morning, and there are people sitting around outside with a fire pit talking about how to do real public safety and community building. And among all the amazing and wonderful things that have happened at the square, one thing is that a woman named Janelle Austin, with many other people, but I'm going to call her, is really taking a lot of leadership. She noticed something right away. Within days of the murder, the corner was just filled with stuff, flowers, dolls, religious icons, candles, poems, works of art. And it was quite overwhelming. And she just said, every one of these things matters. And we, as the people who live in this neighborhood, should treat every one of these things. People brought these things for a reason and they're meaningful. And so she became the curator of the main site, and a lot of people participate, and they take those things and they arrange them in some way meaningfully. When they become decrepit or fall apart, they find a way to decommission them, to archive them, or to dispose of them respectfully. So the thing is, particularity, the recognizing the value of particularity only happens in a particular context. You know, none of us could do that. We don't live two blocks from George Floyd Square. But that was her place, and those things were what she chose to emphasize as mattering. Okay, I'm going to talk about one more thing, which is clearly something I have naturally segued to here, which is social engagement and the diversity of people, of their needs, and of their practices. So my beloved friends of the Flower Girl and Sutra chanting group, you are about to arrive at the joy of the Gandavyuha Sutra. The last chapter of the Flower Girl and Sutra is 450 pages long. It's a chapter. So the sutra was originally compiled of many other texts, and three of those texts that were brought into it were particularly influential. So I'm going to be talking about the last of those, which is the Gandavyuha Sutra. The Gandavyuha Sutra, or Entry into the Realm of Reality, is the third of the key standalone sutras that were incorporated into the flower garland. It constitutes the final and longest chapter of the sutra. It tells the story of a young man, Sudana, who commits his life to liberation from suffering for everyone and everything, and of his long and wondrous pilgrimage on the path. He meets with 53 teachers, each of whom shows him a staggering level of spiritual attainment, and then ends their meetings by saying they can't possibly know the way to liberation. Each one sends him on to visit another teacher to keep practicing. The teachers include beggars, queens, boys and girls, monks, nuns, rich men, mathematicians, sailors, perfumers, goddesses, bark-clad outcasts, doctors, musicians, folks who change genders, people dressed in rags, those bedecked in jewels, a prince who almost loses his life working to free all the prisoners in his land, and great bodhisattvas such as Avalokiteshvara, Manjushri, and Samantabhadra. They teach in myriad ways, all different and appropriate to themselves and those they meet. They teach by feeding people, through physical touch, by making beautiful scents and palaces, by writing, by teaching meditation, by expounding the Dharma, by revealing suffering, and by guiding people through storms. This sutra provides inspiration for those of us looking to create multicultural, engaged Buddhist communities. So the sutra is so much about relationship. Sudana, it's all encounters between Sudana with his deep sense of wanting to free everyone and be part of freedom, and meeting all these different kinds of people and deeply listening to whatever their way of going about it is, and then just moving on. And this aspect of practice, I think, just can't be emphasized enough. Every moment is a moment of relational encounter, always, and can be viewed in that way. And if we view life that way, beautiful things emerge. And I do want to just talk about the immense diversity of people and practices. I've seen so much. And again, like I said earlier, this is very vivid to me, but Minneapolis really showed me like a whole new level or something. So I just want to talk about a little bit about some of the things that were happening as expressions of a person's wish that people be free from suffering. So, as you may know, very soon after, like, they announced this big surge of ICE agents in Minneapolis, we had been in Minneapolis, we've been getting some information from people in Chicago who had been, who organized patrol networks. And they were like, we set up a thing so that if ICE was coming, people in the neighborhood know, they could alert each other. So we got, through a relational context, information about how to take care of people better. And then within days, there were hundreds of people. And within weeks, there were thousands of people who had organized, self-organized into loose networks that could show up on a moment's notice to bear witness when federal agents were bringing violence to our community. And it took a lot of very rapid coordination because the strategy that the federal agents were using was to be there for 5 or 6 minutes or less. So they would often encounter and abduct somebody in less time than that because they wanted no one to be able to do it. So multiple people I know have witnessed federal agents pull someone out of a car and drive away while the car was still moving. And bystanders had to go and put it in park. Other times they go and grab someone and within a couple of minutes they'd driven away and there were children still in the car. So this took like so much willingness to just leap in to the fire. And as you probably know, a couple people who are doing this were murdered by federal agents and many others were tear gassed, pepper sprayed, beaten, detained illegally, lots of people. So like amazing, like that people would just go do this. Why? So they could document it. And why do you know about it? Probably exclusively because they did that. Because the whole point of the strategy was to do it so no one would see it. So how amazing for people to bear witness in this way. But that was like just a drop in the bucket of the things people were doing to take care of each other, because that neighborhood organization I mentioned earlier, there were dozens of other ones that did basically the same stuff. People were mobilizing just to, so many people I met were like, well, I'm not really doing anything, but I do patrol the school every day after work. Or I do drive someone, my neighbor, to work every day for the last 2 months. And, you know, we had singing resistance where you go on the street and just hundreds of us walking down the street singing about how we love everybody and everyone's included. And we had, of course, we had lots of protests. We had Buddhist vigils. We had a Buddhist walk for justice that visited George Floyd Square and the Rene Good Memorial. And 700 people came and we just walked in silence for 2 hours. With only the sound of Incans ringing, ding, ding, just filling the streets. I could go on and on. So many different methods. And, you know, people are like, oh, geez, you go, do I have to like do everything? No, the point is you don't. That is the point, that people can do things. They do things. It's amazing. You know, I just, during this whole time, I could. We started a nightly spiritual call so the people doing the rapid response could come and do somatic meditation. And we would just hang out with them and let them process the trauma and the violence they'd witnessed. Every morning, I just got up and went to the Zen Center, practice meditation, meet with my students, do the service, chant the Heart Sutra, clean the temple, and go do something else. And, you know, one morning I got up and I was at the federal building with a few hundred people singing some nice songs to some riot police. I think riot police must really like songs. And then at the end of the day, I went to the Zen Center and we had a weekend meditation retreat. So there's myriad, boundless, unimaginable ways to practice. But people can do it and it can be really, really beautiful. And I have utter faith that this is true because I'm here. Looking at this beautiful and boundless way of practice that's happening in this space. So I am enormously, unimaginably grateful to get to be a part of liberation. So thank you all very much. And now I think it would be fun to hear more voices. And I'm gonna look at a timepiece here real quick. Yeah. I think the idea is people can ask questions, very welcome. Any kind of question is okay. And you can also have little reflections. Kind of would be fun to hear from people who've been chanting the Flower Garland Sutra. If there are reflections, it's nice if they're a little bit brief because we have quite a few people. And any kind of question is okay. So it could be personal, it could be philosophical. I don't know if I can answer it well, but it's all welcome. Okay.
I'll pass the mic. Please say your name before your question or reflection. If someone's close by to you, feel free to just hand them the mic if they're next. And if you're on Zoom, feel free to type your question in the chat for Kaylin to read, or your name, and Kaylin can unmute you to ask it yourself.
That'd be great. And here from Zoom, some of us were wondering if the share screen could be removed so it'd be a little easier to see Ben.
Yes, we'll do that. Thank you.
Hi, this is Zonio. Can you speak a little more about the connection with the Korean text? I wasn't familiar with that.
Yeah, so in Korea, Hwayeon, the Chinese characters Hwayeon are pronounced Hwaum or something. My pronunciation of all these languages is terrible, so sorry. But it's very influential there. So Huizong is known as the teacher who went to China and studied with Jian, who is Fatsang's teacher, and brought it back and really founded the school. And he wrote this very short text and his auto commentary. This is such a cool Buddhist thing to do. You write a text and then you comment your own text. Anyway, so it's very short. It's very prevalent in Korea, although it's like the people who are really into it, they're like, oh, everyone chants. And then I'll meet Korean Buddhists and they're like, I've never heard of that. But you can find it like printed on bells. People will actually make it as an amulet and sew it in their clothes. So it's considered to have this sort of incantatory power, but is also like a way to, like, you chant it. And, you know, it enables you to kind of touch on the whole spectrum of the Hwayeon teachings. You, oh, 9 times, 10 times, what's that? Oh, one is all, that sort of thing.
Thank you. I'll have to look more into it more. Thank you.
Yeah. And while we're moving the mic, the really fun thing is it's written in a labyrinth shape, so it's not in lines. Yeah, yeah. And so there's a whole thing about the labyrinth. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
We have a question
online. Go ahead.
This is from Christine. I'm curious about the process to research and write such a book. How do you not get overwhelmed with the research and then turn something so large in scope and content into something understandable? It's impressive.
Thank you. Well, I will tell you a strategy I have employed. I've written 4 books of commentary, and I always find a text with about 30 lines. And then I'm like, that's going to be 30 chapters. So I look for a teacher who is already understood to be one of the greatest visionaries within their tradition. And then I find a text they made to be a compact outline of the teachings, and they have outlined the work for me. So that helps to frame how I'm going to present the work. And then the research can be sort of daunting, especially I end up reading a lot of academic texts, which I have no academic training, so it's kind of hard. But I keep returning to, like, in this case, Huizong as one of the greatest visionaries of Hwayeon or Hwaum. It's like, he outlined this well, so I can trust that. And then I can just be looking at things that support and draw out the outline of what the teachings are that he already made.
Thank you.
My name is Ed. Do you have much information about the scholarship on the Avatamsaka in India? And then it sounds like it went from India to direct to China. What the circumstances were and the sort of influence kind of on its way to Korea?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure if anyone really knows exactly how it got there. But I do know that, like, 1500 years ago in China, they were really into Buddhism. And, you know, people were making these incredibly arduous treks. Like, they would come back and they just have like a scroll. And it was like, wow. You know, so like in the age of the internet, it's really hard to imagine. You know, one of the greatest figures of Chinese folklore is someone who went Tripitaka or Xuanzang, however you want to think about it, to get just text, actual physical documents. So I don't really know. I'm not sure if there's scholarship saying just exactly what the mode of transmission was, but to give some rambling answer on this topic, what we know is it was really confusing. because Buddhist texts are extremely diverse, the Huayan Sutra with all, it's like, there's all this preciousness. There's this teacher who's like teaching people by hugging them and kissing them. Buddha would have been like, bah! So they were confused. It was confusing and overwhelming. And there was a lot of effort to try and figure out how they all fit together. And actually there's things called panchao systems, which is sort of categorizing them, which was actually big in Huayan. So it does seem that Huayan had a particular resonance with the Chinese world, existing indigenous Chinese worldview. The positivity of it and the relationality was more appealing than the sort of negative renunciatory aspect of early Buddhism. It's why it's generally considered to have been fundamental in sort of forming a truly Chinese Buddhism.
I really like that you mentioned Hannah Arendt. She's one of my favorites. And when I think about like how every action, like everyone has the opportunity to have a beneficial action in any moment. I think of like someone like Eichmann, it's almost like the opposite. And so often I see like that, like unsavory action is often someone else being like, well, someone told me to, then I did it. Whereas the opportunity to do something beautiful is often like not banal. It's someone sometimes like making a choice to take a risk to do something beautiful and good. And I'm wondering, like, how do you see the text, or you see people around you making that choice? Because it seems almost easier for a lot of people to participate in banality.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty easy to participate in a lot of very harmful systems in the United States. I mean, we live on a nation that was founded on land theft, genocide, and an economy that was built on enslaved Africans. You know, it's pretty bad. And that, all that stuff is still in the mix. So, and we could go on and on. So it's like, it's pretty easy to just kind of not be looking at our relationship to all those things. But I think that one of the downsides of this talk I'm giving is it's a little too exciting. You know, it's like, people were, going in the streets and doing all, and we raised all this money. I mean, that was really cool, but all of it was based on years of just like boring meetings. How did I get into all this? I went to a lot of meetings where I was like, what are we even doing here? I thought we were going to save the world. And we're all just like talking about how to get the database in order, or like, doing an hour of check-ins in an hour and a half long meeting. And then my Zen practice, my engagement with this largely is like so simple, so much time, just like, oh yeah, just with the temple, kind of learning how to move the chairs in a way that's kind and careful and beautiful. So I think banal is not a good word. But, you know, when it's like every person has the ability to do something liberative, and then I give this talk, it sounds like sort of exciting stuff, but like knowing sensations in the body, that's the basis of all the liberative activity I'm talking about. Knowing the emotion that's present, and turning towards the sensory, broader sensory field, and just finding a little offering, that's pretty good. That's probably solid. Solid practice. And then at some point you might like think of something really kind of, wow, oh, jump on in. That's what I think. So thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, this is Thomas. I was curious how you even came to be interested in the Flower Garland Sutra, like what drew you towards it, and what was the thing that like continued your interest in it?
Yeah, so I've been very inspired by Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese teacher. And because, you know, I think he was really brilliant at creating a way, like a modern and postmodern contemporary Buddhist movement that was about both personal and collective liberation, which to me is just like, that just sounds like what I want my life to be about. So it's like very deeply according with that. And he clearly took as like some of the main bases for how to do that from two traditions, the Yogacara tradition, about which I've written two books, and the Huayan tradition. So in one way, I'm just really following his vision and just trying to help bring forth what he was trying to plant as seeds. And yeah, I mean, the part about the joyfulness, I'm kind of into it. I've had plenty of misery in my life. Like I've had a good, solid heaping helping, and I'm like, I'm ready for something else. And I feel like I'm ready for everyone else to have something else too. So there's something about the joyfulness that I love, and that the fact that it very successfully articulates why practice is always collective, I think is really, really useful. And so those are probably the key things that drove me towards it.
Thank you.
Thank you for your presence. This is Nancy. This is going to be unpleasant. I was reading about like pushback to people going in the streets and doing the mutual aid and all that. And the point of the article I was reading was these people are doing the white savior thing. They're out there with their whistles and going into immigrant neighborhoods, and that's not appreciated. The immigrant neighborhoods are saying, just go home, because you're not making it worse, but you're not helping. You're kind of helping the other side. And that really kind of knocked me off my feet and it made me sad, and it made me angry, and it made me wonder, is that true? Did that happen? Is it happening? And what to do or what to think?
Yeah. Yeah, well, there's always an enormous array of perspectives. And, you know, I want to do my best to understand everyone as best I can. So understand like that perspective and where it's coming from. And so I only know what you've told me. So I bow to that perspective as you have transmitted it. And yeah, people do a lot of harm while trying to do good. No doubt about it. And I'm not going to unpack what white saviorism is if you're not familiar with it. It is useful to learn about. So
you know what I'm talking about.
Well, I'm familiar with the, yes, absolutely. And what I can say is one really wonderful thing to do is focus on relationships. So, for example, really, my friend Rabbi Ariel Lekach Rosenberg, her temple, Shir Tikva, and then this predominantly Latino temple, San Pablo's, they just developed, during this period, they spent a lot of time doing things together. They held services in each other's space, so that it was easier to understand what the actual needs of both groups are. And there was a lot of mutuality. I remember after Rene Good was killed, it was very chaotic. After the like tear gas had cleared and finally the ice had cleared out, there's just people in the street just freaked out. And these Somali women just showed up with big heaping plates of sambusas and just started handing out food. So the mutual aid, we saw a lot of just going in all directions. And I can say though, practically speaking, if you are going to engage in an activity that is helping people from a marginalized group, really putting a lot of energy into understanding whether it's actually wanted and requested, and being in relationship with directly impacted people is of enormous utility. And it's probably not a great idea to do it if you're not. So
yeah, I'm not clear about how that was organized here and a few miles west of here. At a school where there are a lot of children and immigrant families, and the vendors, the residents, mostly white, were going out and doing that. They were just targeting the school, you know, when ICE was showing up. And I sounds to me like there may have been some back and forth communication, but from what I heard from one of the vendors who was involved in that, it didn't sound like they were having very many one-on-ones, you know, like, what can we do to help? They were just going, okay, get the whistle, you know, start taking notes, start doing video. I don't know how that all ended up. And I'm still kind of on the fence about it, you know, at my community center, there's little whistle kits and know your rights and you can carry that around. And I even have, you know, a little piece of pink paper in my wallet. It's like, this is what happens if you start getting hassled, you know, as if I'm going to have time to open up my purse and get out my day book and get that little piece of paper and find my glasses and, like, you know, read it back to them, you know, like, you can't do that to me.
Yeah, well, I just encourage, you know, this is all about relationships. So it's my experience is any kind of community, there will be profound disagreements. Sorry. Sorry to all the people who just come to their Buddhist community and you're ready for perfection. Oh, mama. So, and this is true in this case as well. So it's all important, you know, trying to understand and keep moving forward. So thank you for raising that up. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And I do think maybe I have like time for one more, maybe two more.
Hi. I mostly want to express gratitude for centering your involvement in social justice with this examination of the text. Like, it's a really, it's a text I'm really fond of. And like, I would have come, whether it was like that or like kind of dried, like I feel like so often when I come for the Dharma, I get like a sanitized, like non-divisive, like aspect. Not necessarily here, I'm not calling anyone out, but like my understanding of the text is so intrinsic to the way that I engage with the world and this like compassion forward. So I really appreciate you coming here and centering that. And I'm also recognizing that like this is a like fairly liberal place and you're taking this lots of places, and I wonder if you experience, I don't know, more pushback to that message in other places.
Yeah, thank you for that. And what can I say? I don't know, when I first started talking more about things like systemic problems, I was talking about race a lot when I first started doing it more with teaching, and people were like, oh, you're gonna get all this pushback. And I think maybe when I'm visiting, no one, you know, they're like, that guy's leaving. You know what I mean? So the people who are excited about it are like, thank you. And the other people are like, all right, okay, that guy's gone. So probably some people don't like it, but I have not received all that much pushback. I mean, I do get hate mail sometimes in emails. It's true. And, you know, there are people that I'm more deeply in relationship with. I can have conversations that are quite difficult where they'll disagree profoundly. So I'm always interested in the opportunity to really talk about it. But one thing it's useful to think about is, because if you are a person who's not directly predominantly impacted by the harm, it's nice to have those conversations outside of a public context. Because, you know, as a white person, I could go to drive around freely in my city, but as a person of color, there was just constant racialized harassment. So just understanding, you know, if you're sort of like, I don't know about this guy, it's good to just to talk about these things in a way that that cares for everyone. So anyway, another rambling answer. All right, I would hear one more voice if someone wants to raise something up or ask a question.
My name is Mess. I'm appreciating the spirit you're bringing and the joy that you're embodying. And I'm also wondering, maybe similar to Dio, like, I'm a trans and in trans circles. And I think sometimes I kind of bring a similar energy and people are like, like, we are suffering. And that is also true. I feel that too. But it's like, how do you hold that tension of like, both are true at the same time and not, you know, like, I don't want to invalidate anyone's experience. And I also want to not pretend like it's only one thing.
Thank you. Yeah. I'm also like, when you're at the grocery store, it's really nice to smile at people, but not too much, you know? And it's pointing to the same thing of like, how do we I believe the Dharma invites us to realize bliss and the joyfulness that we're conscious. Even in the early texts where it sounds a little bit dry, they'll frequently talk about the blissfulness of samadhi. Rapture is fundamental. It's the first step in samadhi. So, wow, sounds pretty nice. But, you know, when we're with people, then that, you know, we want to understand how are you? And so, yeah, I think in this context, I'm holding the space so I can do a particular thing, right? Now, if I gave this whole talk about joyfulness and never mentioned all the stuff that we all know is related to all this suffering, there'd probably be a lot of people who are annoyed or turned off. But it's like what I'm talking about is the response, the pivot. The first noble truth is there's suffering, and the pivot is to action and the joy that can be found in that. So that's the strategy I'm using. But there are many contexts where there may be joy here or there may not, but my expression is different when I'm with someone who's grieving actively, when they're talking to me about their trauma, when I'm sitting at a meeting with a lot of people and they're like struggling, or when I'm in the streets and there's like rage and anger, then I'm not gonna be like, ee! No, I bear witness. I try and understand and somehow harmonize. And I think that seems about right from looking at what this tradition suggests. So I think that's what I recommend. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I think I'm going to wrap up here just because, you know, somebody probably went to work today. I drove here from Eureka, California. It was nice. I got to tell you, I woke up this morning and I packed up my tent and a herd of elk walked through my campsite. So anyway, they gave me a lot of energy. What I want to say is mostly this talk is not intended to say people should be doing any particular thing. It's very specifically about the enormous diversity of ways people can do liberation. So like what I absolutely don't want to do is people, oh, I should be more active. Well, I mean, if you feel that in your heart and it calls you to something, that's great. But what I'm really hoping is for people to recognize the possibilities that we have for somehow making a life that is about liberation are boundless. And there's room for enormous creativity and simplicity and surprise. And it can all happen through, you know, connecting with people, connecting with ourselves, connecting with our environment. So the thing is, I know that's already happening here. I know it. I know people who practice here. And I know what they're doing. And there are a bunch of you I don't know. I have a lot of faith in what you're doing anyway. So I just appreciate it. I say thank you all. And it's been wonderful to have this time with you. I think, I'm going to end with a dedication of merit. And oh boy, do you all like to chant the four vows? Beings are numberless, that kind of thing. Okay. I don't know how you do it. So is the first word beings? Okay. I'm going to say beings, and then you are going to lead the chant. So I'll do the dedication. May all the benefit of our practice here be an offering for the liberation of all beings throughout space and time. Beings are numberless. I vow to end them. Beings are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. Buddha is surpassable. I vow to realize. All right, thanks, y'all. I think this is an informal type of thing, so we can all just get up and do something else.
Thanks, Miss.
Oh, hey. Kaylin, thank you for your help.
Yeah. You're welcome. It was fun to tag team with you. It's time to put me back on the Zoom co-host roster.
Oh, you're always welcome.
Thanks for all you do and being such a wonderful bridge presence into extending this to the Zoom format. I'm always grateful. So
Thanks. Takes a team.
yeah.
All right. Good
Good
night,
night.
friend.